Good afternoon, good evening, and good night. Welcome back to the Shelter and Warning podcast, and thank you so much for joining us today. We are a Monster of the Week podcast, literally. So every episode, we cover a new monster. Monsters can be both fact and fiction, and they're usually hiding in plain sight. The more you know about monsters, the better equipped you are to protect yourself if you ever have to face one. A quick note before we start, if I say anything that is inaccurate, insensitive, offensive, or should be added to, contact me. I'm trying my best to find accurate information on my topics, but I welcome all corrections and would love to have an open dialogue on any larger issues. All social media handles and my email will be in the description, and I'll say them at the end of the episode, so stay tuned for that. Today is a very special episode, and I'm very excited for it. I will be interviewing author Kayla Ingram. Kayla Ingram, if you don't know, is an author who grew up in Chicago, Illinois. She attended Dominican University, where she was lured into getting an English degree after spending too many nights experimenting with hard literary criticism and hanging out with unsavory types, like poetry students. You may know her from her award-winning thriller, The Wicker King, her lesbian romance, The Way to the Stars, or her new Peter Pan thriller, Darling, which by the time you're listening to this episode will be out everywhere. Go order it! You may also know her from her Twitter, on which she goes viral semi-regularly for being both incredibly interesting and very funny. Welcome! Yeah, would you like to introduce yourself, add anything to that?
Certainly. Thank you so much for having me on this podcast. I'm very excited to talk about monsters. It's very rare that people ask authors questions about topics that aren't directly related to the work that they've created, so this is a very exciting interview for me, too. So I have a new book coming out called Darling. It's a Peter Pan thriller. I'm traditionally known for writing kind of like genre thrillers with a contemporary twist. So very, you know, normal town situations with, you know, very unusual things happening in them. And my niches are found family, ensemble casts, and trauma.
All right. So let's start off with, I guess, an easy question, although it may not be as easy as it seems. What is a monster to you? What is a villain to you? And how would you define them? And are they separate?
I do believe that they're separate. My understanding of monsters came at a latter formative period in maybe sixth or seventh grade when I was first reading A Wrinkle in Time. There's a character in that book that's called Aunt Beast, and it's like a monstrous kind of creature that's like covered with hair, has no face at all, and it communicates telepathically, and the main character is trying to figure out a word to call it. Because there are no words for it in you know, English or something like that, and she's running through terms. I think she goes past monster, and the creature is like offended by being called a monster, and then she settles on beast, and then she's like, oh, but the monster is really like nice and kind and familial, so I'll call her Aunt Beast. And I was like, yep, there it is. That's the way I'll think about monsters forward. The definition between something that is like a beast and something that is a monster is the division between cultural understanding and the prey and predator relationship between you and that creature. If you are prey to that, if it is a dangerous creature, it can be a beast. If it is a creature for which you have no point of reference with which to relate to, it can be a monster. Alligators are beasts. Whatever's going on in the deeps of the sea, probably monsters. That's the way I feel about that. And then in regards to like being villainized, I do think that when we are perceiving something as a villain or not a villain, we're doing so from very kind of like a fourth wall perspective of seeing a story and being like, I'm going to cast who's the hero, who's the villain. So for that definition in conjunction with monsters, I believe that it really has to do with perspective. Mm-hmm. So for example, with Frankenstein, we get Frankenstein's monster. And as we are introduced to both the character of Dr. Frankenstein and the character of the monster, even though the monster is called the monster, he's a monster to everybody inside of the book except for us, the readers. And for us, the readers, who have aerial view of that scenario, we have a full understanding that Dr. Frankenstein is the monster and the monster is just a gentle beast.
Yeah, I think that's, we're already off topic, but I think that's where a lot of modern Frankenstein adaptations go wrong, is that they make Frankenstein's monster a villain, in which instead of, and they completely disregard like Mary Shelley's interpretations and themes of the book itself, in which is like, he's not a monster, it's just the way he was raised, and he has no other choice, and he does not know what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had to read Frankenstein last year for Academic Decathlon, outing myself as a nerd, and it was very interesting, because if you go from, like, the monster movie perception of zombies and Frankenstein to, like, the actual book, it's a complete shift in how you view the characters.
Yeah. Another person who has a very interesting understanding of monsters is Guillermo del Toro, the filmmaker. Like, if anybody, I mean, I'm sure most people have seen at least one of his movies, but his entire body of work is a critique on what is the difference between a monster and what is the difference between, like, a friendly beast. Mm-hmm. So if that's your niche, then check out his work.
I will. I haven't seen The Shape of Water. It's been on my watch list for like 3 years. But everything about it is like, everything I've heard about it is like, who's a real monster? What is a monster? What do we villainize? And how is like a villain sometimes a friend?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, it's outsider culture. Like, monster culture is outsider culture. And Guillermo del Toro does a really good job of kind of exploring and understanding that, and like, realizing that like our perception of monsters and villainization in conjunction with like humanization makes it so that people are more likely to feel like people who are like on the fringes of society are monsters, whether that fringe is like an actual person for whom being with others is difficult, or people who are just like of oppressed or minority groups, which is definitely a worthwhile thing to explore, the monster, the dehumanization and monsterization of minorities and oppressed class. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge part of his body of work, even in other things like Pan's Labyrinth or, you know, Pacific Rim and like all of that stuff. But yeah, sorry, I don't want to go off topic.
No. This is awesome. And like, I was fully prepped to go off topic because it's all interesting stuff. And like, you want an interview to be like, you're actually talking about stuff and not just like a rapid fire interrogation. And actually, something that you brought up is, like, a monster is often an oppressed class. I, actually, when I'm doing research for my monster episodes, that's something that I really have to think about and dig into. Like, for example, in the vampire episode, I had to posit a theory. I'm not going to say that this is definitive. But, like, it is really a reflection of, like, the feudal class in a lot of ways. And the historical figures that we remember as vampires or like having vampiric traits are like Vlad the Impaler or Elizabeth Bathory, and they're people who were literally using the bodies of like working class people in order to fuel themselves in some way or another. And I think that's a really interesting perception of a vampire myth, because like, it's not just like a scary creature in the night, it's like a very real fear for most of us.
Yeah, and, like, the vampire-werewolf conjecture is, like, very much a class, it's a class-based metaphor. Like, there aren't any, like, wealthy werewolf characters that we have. Like, that's something that didn't occur to me at all until, like, this year, that, like a werewolf is a working-class monster. And that's, it's wild. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. So, speaking of, like, how you perceive monsters, how you perceive villains, in your books, you have said before that you'll often tell your readers one thing and then show them something completely different. So you'll have your characters say one thing and then show that their situation or their reality is completely different. Why?
I think that that's kind of an integral part of, like, the human condition and being human, is having a mild disconnect between the reality with which you're living and the perception that you have when you are at that very point in time living it. And one of the ways that I think is like really indicative of this is when you look back at your childhood and you remember things that like were kind of a little bit more fucked up than you thought when you were like living it when you were a kid, and you were like, your parents dropped you off at camp and then came like an hour late, and then now you're a parent, you're looking back at it and you're like, I would never leave my child somewhere for an hour unsupervised, what the hell. Like, when you are living your life, there is always a disconnect between the experience that you are having currently and reality of your scenario, whether it's positive or negative. And I think that when you have a character and the character is like, oh, you know, this is what I think about myself, and this is what my school is like, and this is what my whatever, and they're talking directly to the reader, but then the background of what's happening is what's really happening. That's more realistic, and I think that that's a driving force in why my work is, to many people, very much more, like, evocative and real feeling than a lot of other contemporary writers.
Yeah, I keep going back to The Wicker King, so I have read The Weight of the Stars, I, like, want to clear that up. But I did read The Wicker King first, and I've read it a bunch of times since then, just because it's at my local library. Support your local libraries. And and I remember reading it, and, like, I didn't know these characters in a way. I didn't relate to them really in a way. Like, their situations were not all that familiar with me. But it was, like, it was that same thing of, like, I'm saying one thing. I'm saying that I'm fine. I'm saying that life is good. And then behind me, like, you can see things crumbling that I think I really held on to. So, I think I also read The Wicker King a bunch because you have a Daisy character in it, and I am Daisy. and I think I remember reading it, being like, oh wait, I know that name. Is she gonna be? And then she was. And it's rarer than you'd expect to find, like, well written Daisy characters, and I think I just, like, clung on to that representation really, really tightly when I was younger.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I mean, that's all I wanted when I was writing. And I read The Wicker King when I was in college. So I was a baby, and I was just, like, had all these hopes for what I wanted the book to, like, represent, and, you know, the kind of characters that I wanted to have. And it was very important to me to have that, because it dawned on me that I hadn't read any, and I was like, if I get one shot, just one shot to publish a book and I succeed, I want to have at least some of the representation that I've never gotten, you know. This is before Own Voices, so I might have shied away from it, like, now, but, like, back then I was like, I'm going to do it.
No, thank you so much for that. And then, actually, let's talk about Own Voices a little bit, because I've seen criticism of it now, but I feel like when it was first starting to become a thing a few years ago, it was almost revolutionary in a way. So where do you fall on that spectrum?
Well, I think it's actually really important to understand, because I know the person who coined the term. She is a disability activist, like a disability advocate. And she designed Own Voices to specifically address people writing, people with disabilities, like, really, really terribly, like, just completely just horrible, you know? And it kind of, you know, expanded beyond that to, like, a generalized, you know, thing. But I genuinely think that, like, when it comes to certain things like sexual orientation, gender, and, like, race and stuff, things are a little bit more complex in ways that, not, like, complex in regards to lived experiences, but more complex in regards to the way that publishing handles the purchasing of those, you know? So when it comes to, like, disability in fiction, making sure that, like, A, you know, you even have basic facts. B, that, like, there's such a vast disability community. Like, there are more people with disabilities that are, like, registered as having disabilities than there are Black people in the entirety of the United States. And I don't think anybody knows that. So, like, there's this huge disparity between there being, like, a silent majority, basically, that is just aggressively underrepresented, kind of in the same way that, like, women are underrepresented, even though there are more of us than there are men in this country specifically, and that there's so little care put into the design of the works that books that are just, like, absolutely harmful for people's lived experiences are being published. And this is actually something that I was thinking about when I was writing The Wicker King. Everything about the way The Wicker King is designed in regards to both August's mental illness and Jack's physical brain injury are textbook accurate, so that if anybody, God forbid, winds up having the same circumstances as they do, they'll know what's happening. If they wind up, they'll recognize themselves and be able to save themselves, basically, by having that as an option. But with a lot of fiction that includes people with disabilities, like, stuff is just wrong, and it's inappropriate, because, you know, we're writing for people, we're writing for children. And she was trying to address that with, you know, Own Voices. And for, like, race-related stuff, like, there's also components of, like, oh, you don't have the ability to kind of, like, research certain things, you need to understand a little bit more about, like, the learned experience. And I think that the reason why things are kind of splintering now is because we've had Own Voices around for long enough to be able to do, like, advanced critiques of specific business practices. Whereas when it first came out, it was revolutionary because fighting for people's ability to tell their own stories and to write their own culture was kind of just like a, you know, it was like an emotional push. It was a, you know, revolutionary push. It was like people were calling out to be heard. Mm-hmm. And now we're kind of at the stage where we're like, okay, so editors, it's clear now that editors want voices, want to publish diverse books, but we figured out that the issue isn't that they don't want to publish the diverse books, it's that they don't want to publish the diverse books and pay diverse creators. And now we need to focus on that. And then it's like, oh, or when we, because they don't want to publish diverse creators, they're stopping publishing the diverse books, which we also don't need. So like, that's, you know, kind of where the argument is breaking down now. But honestly, when it comes to like social pushes for change and stuff like that, they always start out like really, really bold, really, you know, we must do this. And then as we get more time to analyze the way that things work and the systems of oppression that govern the reasons why we haven't been doing this, they always kind of like break down to a, let's start a movement broken off from this. So let's start, you know, trying to do that. Or like maybe the original, you know, push for this could have been more nuanced and stuff. And that's just like a natural part of understanding the roles that people take in social change, how social movements grow and develop and solidify. So honestly, not to go into this more deeply, because I know we're supposed to be talking about monsters, but me, I feel that owned voices is very important for groups that are suffering from hypervisibility. So groups that are, for which the work that is produced about them must be accurate at the pain of life or death. So trans characters written trans perspectives, they need to be written by trans people right now, because everybody is talking about trans rights and everybody's hyper focusing on them, even though it's a really small group. Autism, you know, there's a lot of like really inappropriate stuff about autistic people that is written by people who are not autistic. Like that needs to be written by own voices. Mm-hmm. Everything else is kind of more of a like, are you going to hire an authenticity writer or reader? Are you going to allow certain people to write certain passages? Are you going to partner with another author who is from this background and you write the book together? Like there are different ways you can handle that, but you know, I'm kind of at a point where I like want to analyze this more technically, as opposed to if I have an emotional push to feel like people must only write books about themselves, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think hopefully if I get the numbers wrong, somebody's gonna tell me and correct me, but I want to say that 11% of books written or published last year were by people of color, which is ridiculously low when you, all people of color, not like a certain group of people of color, it's all people of color. That is very low. And I feel like because we are seeing so many of these books be like pushed again and again and again, it's like diversify your bookshelf or diversify what you read or diversify your authors. Like people don't understand the scope of the issue.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of the dangers that comes with it. Yeah. And you mentioned hypervisibility, and that's one of the dangers that comes with it, is like, people see what's happening, or like people see diversity and they assume the problem is solved when it's a marketing tactic at some points. Like it's not really, nothing has really changed all that much.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's getting worse. Like I remember like, okay, so I've been an author since 2017, which really isn't that long. And I was writing in 2013. So like I've had basically the past maybe 10 years to watch what's going on with the market. And I've literally seen the amount of books in one category that people were fighting to have increased go up. And then when people are like, oh, thank goodness, it's on a positive trend, we can relax, then it starts going back down again. It's like, it's a mess. It's a mess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the issue with diversity is it's not like a one and done thing. You can't be like, well, it's diverse now. We have people of color writing now. We have queer people writing now. We're done. Like, you have to continually be fighting your way for your place there. You have to continually be fighting for that to continue. Otherwise, it just kind of gets quietly dropped behind the scenes and nobody notices.
Yeah, it's the worst.
Mm-hmm. So, complete swing all the way back.
complete topic
back. It's back to monsters. So, I once took a class in which the professor kind of theorized that authors write from one central emotion, right? So Mary Oliver writes from relief or calm. Richard Sykin writes from panic. They kind of have like one central emotion that everything they do is grounded in, What do you think yours is? Do you think you have one? Do you believe in that theory?
Oh, I absolutely write about trauma. Specifically about trauma from a multi-generational perspective. I like to write about kids dealing with traumatic things happening to them, but also seeing their parents for whom traumatic things have also happened to them, and the concept of generational trauma and what you do with that. The Wicker King was absolutely a story about two broken families and the kids dealing with what it is like to be part of a broken family. Jack's family is very broken, internally, and August's family is very broken, externally. You can very much see that, they have no resources. They don't have that much money. His mom is clearly very mentally ill, but she's trying. She loves him, and he knows that. Whereas, with Jack, his family is super cookie cutter, but they don't care about him. They just leave him, at home alone all the time, and it's just really terrible. And you can see how those experiences are ravaging those two characters. And then in my second book, The Weight of the Stars, set in the same town, in the same, with the same people, the main characters, Alexandria and Ryan, are traumatized for their own kind of reasons, but August and Jack and their wife Rena, they are trying to be the best parents possible because they had such a horrible time. And watching the way kids deal with trauma based on whether or not they have even tangentially adults in their lives who can showcase good behaviors and to support them and offer them places of comfort and safety. It's very much kind of almost like a throwaway scene, but there's this part where one of the kids mentions, oh, after we go partying and we're up all late in the night and whatever, we go to, Jack and August's house to have breakfast and we're hungover, and then they make the breakfast and everything. And just them offering their home in that way, you can tell that the kids are affected by that personally and socially by having that place to go to be with adults who care about them and won't judge them for whatever they did in the middle of the night. And that story of how strong you can be when you have those circumstances made it so that the kids in that book were like, okay, these are the things that our parents did. They didn't go very well for them. We can make better choices. We can be strong for ourselves. We can, do what we need to do to get to where we need to go. And then in Darling, Wendy's mom, Mrs. Darling, in the original book, has a relationship with the concept of theater. And then Wendy has a relationship with the concept of theater. And then Wendy's daughter has a relationship with the concept of theater. So in my reboot, Peter, and I'm not going to give any spoilers because it's a thriller, but Peter has a relationship with both Wendy's mom and Wendy. And the way that Wendy perceives Peter before knowing that he had any connection whatsoever to her mom is very different when she realizes that he did. And I think that not only is it important to me to talk about trauma, because I think that trauma is something that you can't avoid really. Even if your parents are super, super nice, stuff happens and that's just what life is. But I think that it's important, especially when writing for children, to write about conquering trauma or ways you can deal with trauma or people you can go to for help with trauma, all of that. And for the generational thing, I think that, and this is very much product of my time, and I no longer enjoy this, but I think that Harry Potter was kind of formative for me in regards to understanding that stories can be about both children and adults. Because a majority of young adult books that came out at the time, it was only about the children. And, their parents were they were orphans most of the time, or their parents were not really a part of it or whatever. But Harry Potter and also A Wrinkle in Time, both do a thing where they're like, these are kids who are walking into a circumstance of a story that's already half written by the people who came before them. And those people are still there to witness the adventure that these kids are going on, about to go on in front of you. And I think that that is a very powerful part of both of those stories because that's the way life is in real life most of the time. We're a product of where we came from and the people that we are around. So it's very important to me to write from a position of trauma and also to create multi-generational storylines within a single book.
Yeah. Along with The Wicker King, one of the books I think I read about at that same time was A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith, I believe. I haven't picked it up in forever. And it was written in like the 20s, I want to say. It's a very old book, but it essentially describes this girl named Francie, I believe, who kind of grows up in like the tenements of Brooklyn, and her life with like her mother, who's very hardworking and very young, and her younger brother and her father, and the book goes off on tangents all the time. There are entire chapters of the story that are dedicated to like her grandmother coming over from Germany, or you know, her like father's mother and her backstory. And I remember that book, I think, so vividly because it paints exactly what you said. It's like we are a product of our times, and unless you like Gone Girl everybody in your life and you're like framing them for murder and you move away somewhere and you cut all ties with them, you know, you can't escape that in a meaningful way, really.
Yeah.
And I mean, that can be a good thing, that can be a bad thing. It depends on, you know, what you take from it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree.
I also want to kind of talk about a word that you just used when you were describing Darling. You called it a reboot. And I think that's a very interesting way to describe, like, fiction in general. What makes it, like, a reboot instead of, like, something else, instead of a sequel, instead of a reimagining?
It's actually, like, a technical reboot. So, when I first conceptualized Darling, it was, like, in 2010, I think. And I had learned that the copyright was expiring, and I was like, yes, finally. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to take an aspect of Peter Pan that I thought was remarkably under-discussed and put a little bit of a flashlight on it, but keep every other thing exactly the same. Like, I'm very, very in love with the concept of this lifting, taking, and dropping. So the entirety of Darling is a chapter-by-chapter direct adaptation of Peter Pan. All of the characters are there. They just have their own modern equivalent. So Captain Hook is Detective Inspector Hook of the police department. Like, there's the mermaids, and in Darling they are like drag queens. There's the Lost Boys. In Darling they are foster children and homeless children. And you know, it's literally just like a point-by-point adaption. And the thing that I wanted to, like, hyper-focus on just really aggressively was the fact that Peter Pan is a serial killer. And they talk about it in the original book in three different places, and nobody talks about it because nobody remembers it, because everybody's memory of Peter Pan is of the Disney movie, where he's just kind of like this mischievous boy or whatever. But they literally say, one, that the Lost Boys aren't immortal like Peter, so they actually grow up. And there are only boys there, and he doesn't take anyone home. Then they say, oh, Peter has, like, memory loss problems and, like, a really bad temper. And every so often, he'll just, like, leave the group and go into the woods. And then he'll come back not having remembered what he did. And then you have to go and find the body. And sometimes you can't find the body. And they literally say that.
Oh, my God.
And then there's this other part where he's like, oh, you know, the Lost Boys or whatever, like, get to a certain age, and he doesn't use the word culls them, but I think it's something like he thins them out. So literally, he takes the children from their homes, hangs out with them until they're roughly 13 years old, and then murders them! like, nobody's really, like, I know there are other, you know, like, oh, Twisted Peter Pan, you know, like, books and stuff like that, but, like, I really wanted to drive forward the point that I am not doing something new with making a book about Peter Pan being a serial killer. The original book is Peter Pan being a serial killer, and I just wanted to write it in such a way that you could see realistically what he is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to try not to give away the, like, twist or whatever in Darling,
okay. But
it's the exact plot of the book until about the last chapter, when, because I think the last chapter of the original book, Peter and Hook have this giant fight, and Peter, like, I think he manages to, like, kill Hook or something like that. And then in my book, like, Peter Pan wants to go to jail because they figure him out, basically. And I wanted the book to be, like, justice for Peter's victims, finally, for somebody to acknowledge that this was the plot of the original Peter Pan, and that what happened at the end of Peter Pan is what made the story of Peter Pan a horror story about a monster, not a like fun adventure story about some kids who came home safely.
Yeah. Monsters, we're back on topic.
Tracks.
We did it. I am now just remembering that my mom picked up like a really gorgeous version of the original Peter Pan when I was like 4, and just like read it to me, and I don't remember any of that. But back of I gotta go reread it if we still have it somewhere.
Yeah, actually, I have one thing to say about that because it's very important to me. The author designed Peter Pan to be read from a parent to a child, and for both of those people to be having a different experience of the story. He wanted the child to see basically the Disney movie version and the adult to see the like actual horror of what's going on. And I only know of one other book that was written to do that, and it's Coraline.
I was just about to bring up Coraline. Okay, I didn't know if you were going to bring it up. I was just about to bring it up. So you say that you write a lot specifically for children or for younger people. I mean, you're not like a new adult writer. You're not an adult writer. And I think it's very interesting how children of all ages, like even teenagers, I'm saying this as if I'm not literally 16, but like how we conceptualize monsters as opposed to how adults, even like new adults, will often conceptualize monsters.
I think there's like, there is a richness to the experience of not having fully formed all of your schemas that makes it so that you are more, schema is it's like a psychology term in regards to the way that like babies and, you know, people as they grow up, you once you see a pattern, your brain internalizes that pattern. It makes it easier for you to recognize other patterns. So like when babies see like a dog and then every other animal is also a dog to them until they like learn that there are cats and all animals are a dog or a cat until they learn that there are like even more animals. Mm-hmm. We do that for like other things. So when people say like, oh, you know, I had a bad feeling about this, it's your brain without your knowledge putting together a bunch of patterns and being like, you might be in danger, you know. So children have a variety of schemas. You get more of them as you grow up. They are responsible a lot of the time for a lot of our prejudices. For example, queer-coded villains, like when you grow up and you see like, you know, all these villains and they're so fantastical and you know, flamboyant and kid and whatever, and then you grow up and you're like, oh, those are just gay people.
Ursula is a drag queen. Ursula's literally like, a drag queen.
Exactly, like that's a drag queen villain, and Disney has made like 17 drag queen villains, and now people see a drag queen and they're like, I feel like she might be evil, but I don't know why.
Yeah, we that's do know why. It's evil. Just
sorry. Yeah,
yeah.
But like, you know, and then it turns things that were you looking at something and learning something like, oh, you know, I know the history of Disney's and whatever, and making it a feeling. So when people look at, you know, oftentimes minority groups and they're like, oh, that type is untrustworthy. And then you remember that there's been history of portrayal of this group as untrustworthy. And that's why they feel that way. And they don't know why they feel that way. They're just like, I don't know, like something about it just makes me uncomfortable. And like the reason is because there have been schemas that are formed to influence their prejudices without them having like upfront in your face prejudices, their, you know, internal feelings based prejudices. And in regards to monsters specifically, when kids don't have as many schemas as adults, their ability to recategorize or recontextualize the concept of a monster is so much more broad than when adults perceive things as monsters. Like, When a kid is experiencing Coraline, they are experiencing Coraline as an adventure story. An adventure story in which there is a chance for Coraline to win. Okay? When adults are reading Coraline, they are seeing a child that is being groomed, first of all, that is in immense danger because her parents are no longer there. Like, physically, they are not there. They're trapped in a snow globe, and the snow globe's on the other mother's mantle. So, like, the parents aren't there. So the actual real-life security of her safety is missing. And then there's the feeling of, like guilt, shame, of understanding that the neglect, like, the mild neglect that the mother was giving her at the beginning of the book, like, oh, I'm too busy to do whatever, created an environment where the child is immensely susceptible to being groomed by a villainous mother figure. And that feeling of shame, guilt in regards to their own relationship with their children, and the realization that without doing much of anything, they could make their they could prime their mm-hmm. child become a victim, is the schema that heightens the fear in adults mm-hmm. in a way that is lacking completely for kids. We're just like, she's going in the tunnel, yeah! You know, it's not because the kids are stupid, it's because they don't have that perspective, they don't have the schema set up for them. So when you're an adult and you are writing a book that's for kids, you have to be able to understand that, like, what it is that you're building for them. They have the ability to create a richness of imagination with, like, an openness of, like, a lack of fear mm-hmm. that adults might not necessarily have. And one of the ways that that is indicative in my own writing, specifically for The Wicker King, because it's a much scarier story than The Way of the Stars. The Way of the Stars is a sad book. The Wicker King can be like a spookier book. With The Wicker King, what I've noticed, because I read all of my reviews, is that most of the people who are younger are reading The Wicker King, and they are able to perceive and understand the world that Jack is in and August sees. They can imagine, they can fill in those blanks with the, like, tiny little keywords, and like, oh, you know, this animal looks like a horse, but it has too many legs. Oh, you know, it's dark for way longer and sunlight for a very short time of the day. And those things, they stick in the imaginations of the younger readers, and they can see that world that exists, and they are fine with only being shown the reality of August's, like, contemporary non-fantasy book life. Of him, you know, hanging out with Jack and making him food and whatever and mm-hmm. stuff like that, but still understand that on the periphery there is this lush, rich world that Jack has access to. Whereas, like, a lot of the older readers are very, very focused on the, like, medical perspective of that, the neglect perspective, the, you know, like, what's going on with all of these stuff with the teachers and the parents and nobody helping them. And a lot of them are like, I wish that I could have read more about Jack's world. Like, I really wanted to explore more of what was going on there. And, like, I have no feelings whatsoever about, you know, whether or not that's something that they wanted. Because at this point, I can't write anything more about that because Macmillan owns that intellectual property now. But it's really interesting to see for me that is so, without me even intending to do that, is how people are reading mm-hmm. a work that is both contemporary and in some ways fantasy.
Yeah. I do remember reading it for the first time, and I don't think that I assumed Jack had a medical condition at all until, like, the very end. Like, I think I was assuming that it was going to be a fantasy book, and I was assuming it was going to be like I don't remember the book. I think it's been about a year since I read it last. He solves the villager's problem in this fantasy world, and then that's the story. Like, that's, or something else happens in this fantasy land. Like, that's where I assumed it was going the first time I read it. I was like 12. And then I remember at the very end being like, oh, it's a very real problem all of a sudden. It's not like an allegory or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But on the reverse of the monster talk that we just had, where adults will find something terrifying and then kids will find it like, hey, okay, this is interesting, this is fun. I think there are also stories in which kids find them horrifying and adults are like, this is normal. And the first one that came to mind for me was The Giving Tree. Which, if you don't know, The Giving Tree is a story about a boy who is friends with the tree, or he, like, hangs out with the tree, and it kind of protects him, and then as he goes through life, the tree gives him apples, and the tree gives him branches, and the tree gives him wood, and at the very end of his life, the tree gives him, like, a stump to sit on, and it's almost shown as, like, a moral of, like, oh, well, like, be nice to people, but I remember really hating it when I read it when I was little. And it, because to me, I was like, oh, just, like, give people everything you have, and then they will like you.
Yeah. Same with, the Rainbow Fish.
Hated The Rainbow Fish. I hated that book so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I think one more place that I've seen this happen a lot is the book Ella Enchanted, in which adults will be like, fun fantasy romp, and kids are like, oh my god, I hate it. Ella Enchanted, by the way. I have to remember that, like, my parents are listening to this, and they don't read, like, books in English a lot. They didn't have, like, the childhood that I did. Ella Enchanted is a, it's a book slash movie about a girl who's cursed at birth to have to listen to, like, every single command that she's given, and she can never tell anybody about her curse, and it's kind of played for, like, embarrassment humor and laughs, and she has to go on a quest to get rid of it, I think, or she ends up, like, on a quest, there's, like, a prince involved, and it's very high fantasy, very fun, but, like, the premise of it as a kid was terrifying. Oh my god.
Yeah, I think that with adults, like, you so easily forget just how little agency children have. I actually, it's gonna sound weird, I don't read that much young adult fiction, I mostly just read middle grade, and the reason I like middle grade is because it's so honest to how little power children have in their own lives, and when they're able to, like, triumph against evil and whatever, like, they're doing so with no money, with no recourse, they are physically smaller than all of the villains, like, it's just so much honesty in regards to that. And, like, with Ella Enchanted, being a kid and understanding that you can't your own safety whatsoever, and now, you know, anybody around you has the opportunity to make you hurt yourself or others, is absolutely terrifying. Whereas, like, for adults, I feel like you get so used to the understanding that you're in control of your own destiny that, like, you know, that's just like, oh my god, I really wouldn't want it if somebody, like, made me walk naked to work or something like that. Like, you don't think about, you know, the actual, like, sorrow of helplessness as much, you know?
That, I feel like I keep bringing up other books, I'm sorry.
That's cool.
Yeah, I just read all the time as a kid. I didn't do anything else. But I think the Mixed Up Files of Miss Basically Frank Wheeler actually captures this very well, in which I very vividly remember them being like, they run away from their home, and they go to live in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, I want to say. And it's a girl, Claudia, and her younger brother, and they're like 12 and 10 at most. And I very vividly remember them, like, hiding under the bus seats of their school bus. And I'm like, oh, I used to do that when I was a kid. And they, like, count up all of their change, and it's, like, $22. And they're like, it's $22, we're gonna be rich. but, like, it's, and they, like, they end up fine, because it is, like, a middle grade book, I think. But, like, there's something about that book that very clearly communicates that, like, kids are little. They don't have a lot.
Yeah, it was like an adventure story, but there was always this kind of, like, miasma of melancholy over the book. Not, like, in, like, as dramatic as a way as it could have been, but there was just kind of this sadness to it that I remember being aware of even as a kid, and being like, what they are doing is fun and interesting, and I understand it, and I love museums and stuff like that, but they wouldn't be doing this unless they needed to.
Yeah.
And I think that the helplessness of that made it feel like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Yeah. So now that we're on the topic of kids, so what advice, what advice would you give to your younger self? And that can mean, like, anywhere from your younger self, from, like, kid, teenager, to when you were in college or, like, starting to write or anything like that. And what do you think she would say to you?
I think I would tell my younger self to be more outgoing in high school. I actually had a really interesting formative experience. When I was in middle school, I actually went to, like, a suburban middle school and had, like really no parental supervision. So I was just completely wild. Like, I was one of the, you know, popular kids in my grade, and we used to, like, hang out in the middle of the night and, like, you know, sneak into the movie theater for free and, like, do, like, an unreasonable amount of party drugs. And then when I went to high school, so, like, I was, like, 13, and I was like, haha, pill addiction. And then I went to high school, and there was this day, and I was freshman year, like, in the middle of the year, freshman year, and I was like, things are different now. I'm of an age that if I continue to do what I'm doing and, you know, just do whatever and stuff like that, my life can become really bad. Whereas, like, when I was in middle school, it's, like, whatever I'm doing, like, you know, if I'm doing whatever I was doing back then, like, if my parents stepped into that situation, that should have solved immediately. Yeah. Like, there wouldn't be any issue whatsoever. They'd be like, you're no longer allowed to hang out with this person and this person. I'd be like, cool, fine, whatever. And I was just like, this is a scenario that is too dangerous for me to be having as much fun as I used to. And I stopped doing everything. Everybody knew me as like a straight edge. Like, I never went to parties. I never did anything. All I did was write books at home in my room. I've been writing books since I was 12.
Oh,
I've never written short stories, but only written novels. I'm a novelist. But yeah, I literally just did nothing. I didn't date anyone really. Actually, no, that's not true. But I dated a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it was only one of those things where it was like dating people in school, you know?
I have seen your Twitter thread about your, like, your pentuple of people that just kept...
I was having that kind of fun. But, like, you know, if you can't go to anybody's house or, like, you know, whatever, then, I mean, it's basically, like, what's the point? But yeah, and I really feel like I should have pushed my parents harder to be like, I want to have these experiences. I want to go to concerts with my friends. I want to be able to, you know, do parental supervised activities in the night. I want to introduce my friends' parents to each other so they like each other. I would like to go, you know, on a little vacation with my friends and bring my friends on vacation with us. Like, I think that I would have had a much richer experience because I was kind of saving that for college because I knew that I would have had more space to do what I wanted, but also the maturity to protect myself. Mm-hmm. And I went to like some tiny Catholic school and all the parties were terrible. And I was like, this sucks. I went to no parties in college, needed nobody in college really. And that was terrible. And then I think my younger self would say to me that I know what I'm doing. So like I know, you know, I'm in control of my own destiny, and I know, you know, that what I'm doing is what's best for me.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point in time, I feel like I just feel nostalgic for the idea of having fun in my youth. But I think back then, the boring choice was probably the correct choice.
Yeah. You're making me rethink some things now, because I've been effectively stuck inside for like a year and a half or so. I'm just busy a lot. But you mentioned destiny actually quite a few times in this interview. And one thing that comes up a lot in monster stories, whether it's vampires, whether it's werewolves, but whether it's like region specific ghosts or demons or whatever, is the idea that it is destiny, right? And so, like, you get things like the Woman in White, which I want to say there is a Spanish name for it. I cannot remember it. I'm so sorry. Which is like, oh, well, if you're a woman and you have somebody cheat on you, or you die at the hands of, like, you have, like, a male partner do something to you, this is what you were going to become. You know, if you are, like, sirens or mermaids, if you are a woman and you die at sea, or you love the sea and then you die, this is what you are going to become. And I think that the concept of destiny is very interesting and also very much, very contentious in a lot of ways.
I agree. I think that in regards to like monstrousness, a part of the monstrousness of things that people can become, there are different categories of monsters. There's monsters that were something and now are something else. There's monsters that were always one thing. And there are monsters that came into being because of the actions of XYZ, and now it's like a problem, like, you know. So I think that for monsters that were people that became something else, a part of the monstrousness is the non-consensual body horror transformation phase, where what you were is stripped from you, which is kind of like a, you know, psychological violation. And then the physical transformation against your will is like it's a physical assault on your personhood, and the hopelessness of eternity is also a part of that as well. Because all of these creatures that humans turn into, they're not turning into them for a short amount of time. They're turning into them forever. Their human lifespan was the short time, and now they're forever going to be the monster that they turned into. And that the concept of all of those things together is like a devastation of all facets of what we understand is our personhood. And I think that is a huge part of why we fear them, because we are trying to avoid that devastation. Mm-hmm. And I think that when it comes to storylines that include these characters, they almost always include a aspect of that monstrousness in which, in order to find satisfaction for the audience, they have to ascend above their destiny. And this would be an example of like, oh, you know, a werewolf that manages to keep his werewolfiness inside and not tear apart his girlfriend.
Twilight.
Or, you know, a vampire that, it was a comic book, but it was a movie that a decent amount of people have seen. It was called 30 Days of Night, and it was about like vampires that go to the Antarctic to, you know, eat a whole bunch of indigenous American people because they have night for 30 days, so the vampires don't have the sun ever, and it's about the indigenous people like fighting off the vampires, and the main character winds up getting turned into a vampire, and at the end of it, he like sits and waits for the first day after 30 days of night to die in the sun. And like, you know, just all of those stories, the moment where you're just like, ah, yes, you know, greatest story ever, is always when the monster, you know, gives up their monstrousness in exchange, usually for like death or for ascension of some kind. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's what I think about that.
not to involve supernatural in things at all, but I watched Supernatural in like 2015, 2016, and I've just been dragged back forcefully. So now I'm stuck here. But that's one thing that the show actually brings up a lot, almost unintentionally, which is the idea that like there are classifications of monsters, and the best monster is the one that denies that they are, or the one that refuses to act like them. Or, you know, you get, like, vampires that survived on bagged blood are still, or, like, good vampires, or werewolves that, you know, only eat, like, animals, or good werewolves. But it also very clearly shows that those monsters are still less than human, no matter who the human is. So, you can be, like, a werewolf or a vampire who's Benny. I don't know if you've seen Supernatural.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. Benny's my favorite.
I love Benny so much. he deserves better. But spoilers for season 9, I think, of Supernatural. But Benny survives on bagged blood, and he's kind of just, like, hanging out, not hurting anybody. And he still ends up being sacrificed for Sam Winchester, because, after all, he is a vampire. And Sam is not.
And he needs to die.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be said about Supernatural, but I think, because I recently watched it during quarantine, because, I mean, everybody had the time.
I'm so sorry.
It was a very long 3 months of watching that, but anyway. It's very clear to me that Supernatural was written by somebody who loves monsters, but doesn't understand, like, or doesn't understand monsters and has not analyzed monsters in regards to what they mean in, like, human storytelling culture. And in the same vein for Guillermo del Toro, it's very clear that he has. And so, like, all of his, like, allegorical stuff, all of his, you know, this human is a stand-in for a monster, or the racial makeup of his cast and stuff like that, like, all gives deference to his understanding that when we talk about monsters, we are, in essence, both talking about, you know, inherent human fears, but also we're talking about the environment of people with which we are, you know, a part of. And the way that Black people and Asian people are treated supernatural is, like, I could talk about that forever. Like, it's every single Black person was a villain eventually. Like, whether they arrived as a villain, they died as a villain.
I was talking about this literally yesterday. I was talking about this yesterday night with, like, a friend of mine. Because there is an episode, I think, early on in Supernatural, in which they introduce Gordon Walker, who is the frame of that story, the frame of that episode, the way that that episode is created, makes the assumption that their audience is racist, and then uses that to tell the story.
Yeah. And then, like, when you think about Black characters in that, and I'm going to talk about the Asian characters too, because I have a lot of feelings about that, but the Black men, all villains, whether they're introduced as a villain, they eventually die a villain. The Black women, sexy, stupid. The character that Dean has, the very first love interest that Dean has in Supernatural is a black woman.
Cassie.
And he, like, so, she so much has feelings about what it is that they're doing that she, like, kind of gets in the way of their ability to do their job. And then they have one more black woman character, and she is married to a hunter who's super, super anti-monster, you know, racist mm-hmm. or whatever, because they frame the hatred of demons in some circumstances as, like, a form of, you know, racism. And then she is, like, so so irrational by her husband's death that she, like, does something really stupid and winds up dying too. And then there weren't any Asian people, and I'm saying Asian as in, like, South Asian, East Asian, Southeast Asian, none of them.
There was, okay, I have, I watched the show with my, like, secret good Supernatural that lives in my head goggles on, and I have actually done analysis onto the portrayal of Asian people in general on the show, and then, like, Desi, South Asian, Indian people in general. There is one. There is one.
There's one.
There's one. They treat her terribly. And she's Kalika Devi. She's like the goddess Kalika or Kali. And they have Lucifer kill her. And she's like stupid and she's like erratic in a way. And she's like hot lady who dies.
Yeah, and it's like, so when it comes to like TV representation, like people and the way that we've handled not being put in stuff has been completely chaotic. Like, we got in the stuff, we're in everything, but like the way that they treat us is still like kind of weird and bad, because our push has always been include us or we will make a big deal about stuff. So like, you know, if a show had no black people, like all of black people are just like, so we noticed your show has no black people, and then they're like, oh man, here are the black people, come to complain. And that's been our relationship with Hollywood for like ages and ages and ages. So we've gotten to a point where they can't not put us in, basically. So I no longer judge a show about whether or not it's like has a good understanding of like diversity and, you know, presence of people if it has black people, because I know that they compulsorily put us in just because that's like a thing now. I judge it on whether or not they have Asian people at all, because there aren't that many black people, because we some of them have visibility, but like it's like 9% versus 12%. That's not that huge of a difference. And if you have 4 black characters and no Asian characters until the 4th season, that tells me more about the way you feel about people of color than whether or not you have black people. So when I was watching Supernatural, I was just like, ah, yes, one more episode with 0 Asian people, including background characters who have no speaking roles who walk in the background. Like, no, I'm not about that. By the way, you can cut this part out. This is totally a rant.
No. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's definitely something that's worth having a lot of contention on in regards to, like, monsters, monster hunting, and the way they treat black hunters. Like, I remember they weaponized, like, white supremacy to get one of the black hunters who was like the best hunter basically before them, like to get him put in jail.
Yeah.
And like I was just watching it and I was just like, there is so much, like I'm gonna finish the show, but there's so much to say about the violence of that writing decision in the writer's room of this mm-hmm. show. And yeah, but
okay so coming back to our discussion about fandom, I want to say you've been involved in fandom for, like, about a decade, maybe a little bit more. And, like, fandom is not that old. It's, like, concept, it's really not that old. And so I feel like you've kind of seen it grow and fall and change. What do you think determines whether a piece of media will have a fandom?
This is such an interesting question. Okay. I think that, first of all, I think it's important that you know before I kind of go into this that I'm kind of like a fandom scholar. I've been studying fandom for a really long time. I have spent a lot of time doing research on like fandom spaces, fandom creation, the history of fan fiction. I did my undergrad thesis about fandom and fan fiction culture. Like I've been a part of fandom culture since before the structures of the way that we consume fandom content were the way that they are now. So like I'm not as old as the zine like culture, mm-hmm. like yeah. Star Trek zine, people mail them to each other, but I am old enough that I remember the mailing lists where you would subscribe to like a Yahoo mailing list. You would get an email and the email would have like fan fiction links that were on the black net.
I have also been involved in fandom for a long time, but I'm 16, so there's, 5, 6 years for me is, like, a long time. That's still not Phantom is older than that. And I was about to be like, do you remember LiveJournal? Do you remember the fall of LiveJournal and like fanfiction.net and it being sued and Anne Rice and all that?
Oh, yeah. Actually, there was like a before LiveJournal, and I'm not going to go into this because I can literally talk to you about this for 3 hours because I had to defend about it for that long.
I want to hear it. This is okay.
Yeah, so before LiveJournal, there was Angel Fire and GeoCities, which was a website where you would like build your own website. And like everybody was kind of shitty at web building, kind of like early aughts of Tumblr, where you just like make your own background and you're like, cool, I learned basic CSS and HTML because I wanted to have my site be green and for there to be music. That's how it was on GeoCities and Angel Fire. This is like back in the Yahoo Mail days. Like, I don't even think Gmail existed yet. And basically, Yahoo purchased Angel Fire at GeoCities, which is where a majority of all fandom content, meaning all of the women, fandom was women, like at the beginning, it was just us. They had taken all of the like scenes and stuff, like photocopied them, and, like typed up people's stories, stories that were so old that the people who wrote them have died. So like 1960s, 40-year-old women writing fan fiction about Kirk and Spock and whatever, and they put those all on their own private websites. And Yahoo woke up one day and deleted 90% of all of those websites. So all of that culture lost, gone forever.
Modern day Library of Alexandria.
It was a nightmare. Oh. And then LiveJournal became a thing and everybody was so anxious and nervous about them doing that to LiveJournal. And then something very similar to that happened. Everybody was like, no. And then they did that for, you know, fanfiction.net had a similar thing where like they started deleting all the like explicit fan fictions and stuff. And then I think it was like four of the biggest writers in fandom culture came together and built Archive of Our Own with the rudimentary like web building skills that they created, you know, because they're authors. Like all of them are just authors. And so anyway, so my understanding of like fandom culture and like what makes a fandom and how does that work and whatever is like incredibly nuanced and very historical.
Oh my God, so, I want to hear everything about this, but you do have to go. Okay.
So, basically, instead of it being more about, like, what is, like, whether there will be a fandom about something, it's more about people who make content can tell whether or not a content can be successful based on whether a fandom forms. And generally speaking, fan fiction, because fan fiction is kind of like the base of fandom culture. You've got fan fiction, and then I think it's costume and cosplay and then fan art. So fan fiction dictates what happens in all of those spaces. So fan fiction is broken up into two categories. Fan fiction about a thing that is like action packed, where all the fan fiction is slice of life. And then the other category of fan fiction, or the other realm of it, is adding elaboration to things that are all character development. And the best way that you can kind of see the difference between that is Star Trek fan fiction and Star Wars fan fiction. Star Trek has a lot of like kind of like emotional, actually, let me make sure I'm doing this correctly. Star Trek has a lot of like emotional development and a lot of, you know, like exploration of like, the world and stuff like that. Or like an emotional buildup, but no like hard emotional like development, I guess. And a lot of really intricate world building, details and stuff like that. Star Wars has a lot of emotional stuff that you get like catharsis for, and like just ways that things have like come. It's a family story about families, Lion King, but it's based basically, and very broad strokes of world development. And when you look at the fan fiction that is written for both of those right next to each other as both being like massive space odysseys, a majority of the Star Wars fan fiction is world building, is detail interested in what's going on this planet. Let me look further into the Knights of Ren. Let me look further into Sith culture. Let me look further into whatever. They're building the world from the shreds that were given to us so that we can choke down the emotional drama of these characters. Trek, on the other hand, you get the world, you get the detail, you get the you know, alien stuff and whatever, and everybody wants to delve into who's in love with who, what's the slice of life, what's going on with that? Teen Wolf Everybody's running in the street screaming. Lots of people are dying. Complete chaos. All they want, slice of life. You know, hurt and comfort with more comfort. Mm-hmm. Fluff or whatever. Yeah. And then you take something where it's like, it's all fluff. They're like, we want to hear about them fighting zombies. We want to hear about them, you know, going to space. And like, people will just create that for it. Yeah. So basically, fandom exists because people have found something that is lacking within a piece of media. They've been given just enough sprinkles of spice that they understand what's missing and they want to play in the world that's been built for them and mm-hmm. build up what it needs to be a whole. So for example, Black Panther, the film, does not have a lot of fandom content because it was fully satisfying both from the world building perspective and for the emotional development and catharsis of all of the characters. What do? What is there to do? Nothing. So you're like, yeah, I had a great time. Movie's great, you know. And then when you see something like, you know, Doctor Who or something, you get all the adventure and like very little of the like emotional catharsis or more emotional catharsis and you need more detail about what's happening. And then you, you know, build that yourself. So when it comes to fandom culture, let me re-look up this question. When it comes to that, I think that whether or not a fandom will be born is whether or not it appeals to the current zeitgeist, but also whether there's enough in it that is missing and enough in it that we've been given mm-hmm. in order to build upon.
That was so cool. I could listen to you talk about that for 3 hours. Lightning round? Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go for it.
3, 2, 1. You just mentioned this. Star Trek or Star Wars?
Star Trek.
Star Trek. Vampires or werewolves?
Used to be vampires, but now it's werewolves.
Ooh, okay. Sirens, like creepy, terrible, luring men to their deaths, or a mermaid?
Sirens.
Sirens. Cool, 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 cool. Realism or fantasy and sci-fi?
Fantasy and sci-fi. The kind of writer where you do contemporary, but it feels like fantasy, where it's like everything can really happen, but because it's so fantastical, it feels like you're reading a fantasy book. Mm-hmm. So that one was hard for me.
Yeah, I was writing it down. I was like, is this cruel? Yeah, whatever. It's fine. tattoos or piercings?
Piercings.
Mm-hmm. Aesthetically, just aesthetically, 1920s, 2020s?
1920s.
Okay. Reality TV or scripted TV?
Reality TV can sometimes be really good, but I prefer scripted TV.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's assuming that reality TV is not half scripted anyways, but...
That's true.
Angels or demons?
Angels.
Ooh, that's an interesting answer. I wasn't expecting that one.
Angels... Okay, so this is before your era, because something has actually changed in the way, not to like go into more detail, but like something about the way that books have been divided. There mm-hmm. is now a very rich Christian publishing like world where their books are completely separate from, you know, the generalized publishing world. And when I was growing up, that divide wasn't as firm. So there was actually a lot of books about angels that came out like in the early 90s and the late 80s and the early 2000s that were specifically about angels not being like, you know, like a god avatar, but whatever, but instead being their own specific kind of monster.
Ooh. Okay.
Which is really cool.
That is very
cool. So like, you'll talk to people and it's mostly like mid-level millennials who will be like, angels, 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 because we're like roaring balls of fire. They don't like humans for real reasons. Like, there was like a huge like boom of this book called The Left Behind, which is about like these teenagers who were left behind on Earth after the rapture. They were having a bad time. And like the literal like Armageddon was happening and angels are fighting demons. They're like hiding in a gas station like, oh, okay. Like that whole happened when I was a kid. So okay. Angels.
I gotta go find this book now. all right. Aliens or the fair folk / fairies?
Fair folk. Fair Ooh. Folk. I'm a Scottish girl.
Okay. Fandom now or what, from when you were a teenager? Or like when you were younger?
Fandom now.
And I'm sorry in advance, The Wicker King or The Weight of the Stars? You gotta pick one of your babies, I'm sorry.
Ooh, The Wicker King.
Thank you so much, you're so cool, oh my god. Do you want to give like a quick little spiel of Darling so that we can end the episode with like, go and buy it. It's in stores, go buy the book.
So, okay, give me one second. Let me form a good one. So my next book, Darling, is a Peter Pan reboot. It is a reboot about a girl named Wendy, and it's set in Chicago, modern day Chicago. And it is, in essence, about Peter being a serial killer. There are actually a couple of other Peter Pan books that are coming out this year. There's Aidan Thomas's, I think, Lost in the Neverwoods is what it's called. And there's one more, but I can't remember the name. But all of them are very, very different. So if you are in a Peter Pan mood and you're looking to see what Peter Pan book suits your fancy, Aiden's is fantasy, mine is contemporary. His is about, you know, I think it's about this, like a girl kind of like going into another world. And mine is about a girl who, you know, moved from the suburbs into the city and met a cool boy and was like, I'm going to have a great night out with him, and does not. So, like, so it's definitely two different experiences. Please pick up his, please pick up mine. If you're a fan of the original Peter Pan, mm-hmm. it definitely will satisfy.
Okay. And even if you're not, and you're looking for, like, if you're looking for middle grade work, if you have kids that you think might be interested in it, if you are a reader in any sense, go buy it. This book's going to be very cool. I already have it pre-ordered, and I'm so, so excited to read it. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope this episode of the Shelter and Warning podcast entertained and educated you. And if it did, please consider leaving us a rating or review on iTunes, and also go check out Darling. You can find the Shelter and Warning podcast at Shelter and Warn on Twitter or on Instagram, TikTok, and Tumblr at Shelter and Warning podcast. You can also contact us through email at shelterandwarningpodcast@gmail.com. You can find Kayla Ankrum on Twitter at Kayla Ankrum, or at her website, kankrum.com. You can also find her books, The Wicker King, The Way to the Stars, and Darling, wherever books are sold. Once again, if there are any corrections or additions that you would like to make, contact me and I'll do my best to address them. Thank you so much for listening, and good luck. You'll need it.